Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Casual followers of American foreign policy often describe it as partisan, reactive to world events, perhaps even inconsistent. But scholars in this area, and in particular historians, identify consistencies across administrations. The large-scale, long-term strategic challenges of statecraft, politics, and social change is referred generally as grand strategy. What exactly has been the grand strategy of the United States, in particular historically, and what does this mean for contemporary foreign policy? A new book from Oxford University Press, titled Rethinking American Grand Strategy, cites numerous top American historians to examine this question of American grand strategy. We have three of the contributors of the book, including one of the editors, on today's show. Christopher McKnight Nichols is Associate Professor of History and Director of the Center for the Humanities at Oregon State University. He is the author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of the Global Age. He is also one of the editors of this book, along with Elizabeth Bourdwat and Andrew Preston. Beverly Gage is Brady Johnson Professor of Grand Strategy and Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. She is the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror, and a forthcoming biography of J. Edgar Hoover. And Kate Epstein is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University Camden. She is the author of Torpedo, Inventing the Military-Industrial Complex in the United States and Great Britain. Thank you all for joining us. Christopher Nichols, I'll start with you as one of the editors of the book. What ultimately was the motivation to wrestle with this question about American grand strategy?
Well, thank you, Doug, for having us on. It's great to be here with you. So what was the core motivation for the book? I think we had several. The first was a basic kind of question, and I think you teased it nicely in your introduction, which is to say, what is grand strategy? Now, that sounds simple. It's deceptively simple. This is a term and a definition that has bedeviled political theorists and historians. It is hard to pin down, like nailing jelly to the wall. It seems to just keep sliding down. So what we tried to do was bring together a number of historians, some really devoted to understanding grand strategy, teaching it, researching and writing on it, others who really didn't have very much relationship at all to the concept of grand strategy historically and in historical research or in political theory, and asked them to interrogate this question, what is grand strategy, for their different eras using different lenses of analysis, with one then secondary goal being to rethink grand strategy. So not to reject other ways of defining grand strategy necessarily, but rather to expand the parameters of what we think of when we think about grand strategy. And then also, you know, one of the outcomes of the book is to add new theoretical frameworks, new lenses of analysis, new what we call hidden strategists and strategies in the historical record, and also to point out some of the limits. So when is it not appropriate to talk about grand strategy, or when does it seem to fit imperfectly? And what work does it do to talk about grand strategy for practitioners, for diplomats, for social movements, for different kinds of figures over time? So what did it mean to think of grand strategy as a process in different eras, for instance? And so we brought these folks together in a conference first and really rigorously tested out these ideas. And then over a painstaking process, in fact, of some really dedicated authorial editorial changes, including by the two other folks who are joining us here, really came up with some great innovative original work, which we hope will change not just how practitioners and scholars think, but how citizens might approach the question of what is U.S. grand strategy.
And Beverly Gage, you're a professor of grand strategy. So it seems like this is the most appropriate question I can lead with you. What is grand strategy? I think of it in contrast with the book talks about, you know, between tactics and strategy, grand strategy. What do we mean?
That is an excellent question, Doug. And I think grand strategy is a term that's bandied about pretty widely in a certain kind of foreign policy circle. And outside of that discussion, very few people have even heard the term. I teach at a university that's had a grand strategy program for about 20 years, which, as you said, I now head. But even on this campus, lots of people, students applying to the class, other professors have not heard the term before and aren't able to kind of pin it down easily. I think there are a couple of ways of thinking about it. So one is that it's something that states do. So certainly over the course of the 20th century, the grand strategy has really been thought of as something that very elite policymakers are engaged in. Presidents, secretaries of state, the heads of policy planning staffs, that sort of thing. And the idea is that grand strategy is sort of the intellectual architecture that is supposed to bring together all of the resources of any given nation state to achieve some sort of desired end. So often it's thought of in the context of war, and it really comes out of a world of military strategy, but kind of distinct from military strategy, grand strategy is supposed to be about what is the point of all of this and how are we going to get there? So not only how are we going to win the war, but what should the peace look like? How do we amass our economic and cultural and diplomatic and military, all of these resources together to achieve something in the world? So that's really been the traditional definition of grand strategy. I think what's exciting about this book, and this is certainly the way that I teach in grand strategy, is to think about it less in this particular context and think about it more as a method that can be applied in lots and lots of different ways. A method that is basically about thinking about the relationship between means and ends when you've got something really big that you want to accomplish. So my essay in this book takes on the question of social movements and can social movements have grand strategies? And I would say yes, although they look a little bit different than when you have an army and a state at your disposal. But these fundamental questions, what's the relationship between means and ends? And I think especially what the Yale historian John Lewis Gaddis, who established Yale's grand strategy program, defines as the relationship between unlimited ends, kind of these grand aspirations that everybody has, whether you're a state or you're an activist, right? Something really big, and the fact that you're always going to have limited means. And how do you put those things together? How do you make sense of the limited means at your disposal to achieve some big, big thing? So that's really the way we think about grand strategy. And I think it's intellectually exciting, and it's probably more productive for general readers, most of whom are not heading into the policy planning staff of the State Department.
Actually, to follow up quickly with this too, the introduction has a bit of a distinction that gets me thinking about this as well, contrasting between, say, strategies and tactics, and then grand strategy. In particular, I think of, to use a Vietnam War analogy, the strategy is how do you win the war? The grand strategy is why are you there in the first place? Is that a sort of a fair distinction?
I think that's a great way of drawing the distinction between strategy and grand strategy. Grand strategy is going to be about what the really big ultimate aim is. What's the meaning? What's the purpose? Why are we engaged in whatever it is that we're engaged in, a war, a movement? What are we hoping to get in the end?
Kate Epstein, another sort of big issue that I've been wrestling with here, this is a book that's written, I don't know if it's all exclusively, it's certainly mostly by top historians. So as somebody who teaches international relations, I've wrestled with the question of the relationship between history and international relations. Ultimately, what's the utility of using history as a way to try to understand the way that a country like the United States is currently wrestling with grand strategy?
That's a really interesting question, which I don't know that I can give a sort of short, succinct answer to. It's not an easy question. It's very sort of philosophically complex one, I think. So I think about this in a, I think, particular way that not necessarily all historians would think about it in. But I see the use of history and sort of analyzing our contemporary world largely in terms of raising new questions and pursuing new lines of inquiry. I am, in general, deeply skeptical of thinking of history as a source of lessons or analogies, because I think that those often rest on a very simplified version of the past. The historian Samuel Moyne has referred to the problem of what he calls riotous analogy without disanalogy, which I thought was a wonderful phrase. And there's great temptation to do that. And analogies are really more helpful when you're thinking not just about the similarity side of the ledger, but about the dissimilarity side of the ledger, when they're a tool for sharpening analysis and asking new questions, I think, rather than supplying a sort of final answer. So I don't feel comfortable, I suppose, with the way in which I think sort of history is looked upon as a sort of usable resource in what I regard as a quite a narrow and rigid sense by a lot of sort of contemporary foreign policy, security studies, thinkers. And I suppose my other concern about the way in which history is used to inform contemporary debate is that in history, the process, the scholarly process, ought to matter much more than the outcome. It ought to matter much more than the conclusion. And good process is really methodologically very difficult. And it requires, I think, some training to be able to assess and do quality control. And I worry that when history is looked to as a source of lessons or analogies, as it is often looked to in the security studies world, that crucially important details get omitted, which was kind of the argument of my chapter in the volume, and that the real value of history to me in contemporary debate gets lost, which is that if we're kind of shoving history into the kind of categories of analysis that we're using in contemporary debate, then we're really just kind of confirming our own presuppositions about what's important and what's not, when what history can do for us, and paradoxically, in order for it to do this for us, one has to go into it searching not for it to be useful, but to kind of let it speak in its own voice. I think that that's the real value is making us ask questions and think of variables that we might not have otherwise considered.
In part, asking that question, I think I'm going to ask Chris and Beverly the same question sort of broadly, in part because the nature of your chapters, you have these historic chapters giving us some insight into the development of grand strategy in the United States, whether it's, you know, from the state or from social groups. In class, I always like to tell students that the role that history can play is frequently when we ask you to cover a case, you're sort of like joining the play in Act 4, and you don't realize everything that's happened in the past. And so I guess part of my question for you, Chris, is how much is that the guidance from history? How much, as Kate pointed out, is it a challenge to think about what are analogous situations and, you know, do they exactly fit? Or broadly, what else is history bringing to the analysis that just a contemporary analysis of the issues the U.S. faces in the 21st century that it doesn't have if you don't think of it in a historical context?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most important questions for historians, really. And I think Kate did a beautiful job describing the challenges of a usable past, and then the pressures for us as historians and for people using history, political scientists and people in other disciplines, for trying to figure out how to do that responsibly. I think that at its core, that seemed to me to be what Kate was instructing us to think more about. For me, I'll go with a couple of the cliches and then try to dig a little deeper. And I see these t-shirts periodically. They say, you know, history repeats itself, right? And historians are loath to go in that direction. We hate that. So we say things like history rhymes, right? Or there are echoes, that all analogies are imperfect over time. You know, one that my students love to make these days or have in the recent past is the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, right? There are some similarities, but there are so many very salient differences. So what can you do by comparing the path to a war or an authorization for the use of military force, the debates in Congress or lack thereof, activism on the streets, all that stuff, right? So that's a piece of it. How do you move forward with that? And I think it is incumbent on us as historians, and this may be where I slightly differ from Kate, and I'd be curious to know what Bev has to say about this. It's incumbent, in my view, for us as historians, but also for you all in allied disciplines, ones who use history responsibly, to draw out those comparisons and then to note where they don't fit, right? And say, okay, this is as far as we can go with that, the history rhyming element. And this is illuminating for particular reasons. And it brings up kinds of questions that, that Kate was alluding to. But another reason to do this in terms of grand strategy is that all the literature on grand strategy uses as its primary data set US and world history, human history. It goes back to antiquity. Some of the big books on this subject, strategy, you know, grand strategies, right? Rise and fall of great powers. You know, I could list a litany of them. They're thick, they're doorstop books. They go back to Thucydides. They question whether or not democracies can have unitary strategies. They move rapidly across time. And what we historians say, and I think this was the response that we just heard too, we say, okay, let's be very specific about the context, the contingency of the moment. Let's really understand what was going on there, to then get a better sense of whether or not this process of grand strategy, for instance, was something that did match what we're describing as the kind of definitional structure, matching necessarily limited means to really long-term grand ends. I think history is the core discipline, the core data set for this. And therefore, especially if you think about how, as Bev Gage was noting, if grand strategy kind of comes out of a 20th century military context, and if you look at sort of keyword searches and you try to figure out when did people start talking about it, it's really in the World War II moment, the 30s into the 40s, that the concept of grand strategy starts getting used a lot in the Anglo-American discourse, then it makes sense to look at the US in particular and to look at US history over time to try to discern changing patterns in strategies, grand and otherwise. Or as you were pointing out, right, if you go to a Clausewitzian kind of model, there's tactics, there's operations, there's strategy, and then there's grand strategy, that thing that's above all of that. What counts as that? You know, we can get into some of the specifics, I think, but for me, history is the best source of data to mine for that. And then whether or not you want to indulge in, you know, very responsible kinds of analogizing would be up to the instructors in the classes and the kinds of books and articles you want to write.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing a new book, Rethinking American Grand Strategy, with Christopher Nichols of Oregon State, Beverly Gage of Yale University, and Kate Epstein of Rutgers Camden. So Beverly Gage, we've raised these questions, you know, broadly, sort of what insights is history giving the contemporary discourses?
Well, I would agree with Chris that Kate did a great job of laying out many of historians' kind of instinctive cautions about this. And I think that those are all on the money. I tend to be a sort of big tent historian and to think that there are lots of different ways of engaging history, and that, you know, the scholarly approach to thinking about history is one of those ways, but also that it's great for scholars to be engaged in public conversations about history and to be engaged both as a check, as teachers, as experts, as people who actually can learn a lot themselves from these conversations. And so I think in terms of grand strategy, what is particularly interesting for me, especially in teaching it, is to be able to step a little bit outside of that academic historian's box and think about some of these challenges of quote unquote learning from history. So both the students in that class and then many of the people who we bring in to teach that are not going to be people who are going to become academic historians. They're mostly practitioners. For instance, our national security advisor at the moment, Jake Sullivan, until he went back into government, was teaching in the grand strategy program at Yale. And so what's exciting for me pedagogically is to be able to think about the ways that history is in fact deployed in kind of policymaking spaces or in the world of activism, because whether people know it or not, everybody's working off of some kind of historical narrative and some kind of story about the past. And so to be really able to dig into that, to think about ways to use the past responsibly in your own action, and to have in some ways a kind of more human relationship to the past, which is to say there were people 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 2000 years ago, who faced these gigantic challenges, who looked around and said, I live in a world that I would like to be different from what it is. And so not only what did they do, but how did they go about doing that? Those are, to me, really exciting questions, and questions that grand strategy is actually a really useful way into. What are the biggest changes that have happened in human history? And in fact, how did people make them happen? And that, of course, then raises the question, which we also talk about all the time, which is, you know, did people make them happen? And so grand strategy is very much about agency. It's about intentionality. It's about the idea that people can sit down and have ideas about the world and execute those ideas and run into all sorts of unintended consequences. And as Clausewitz would say, run into friction along the way, maybe end up someplace different than quite what they envisioned. But the basic premise is that you can think about the world, you can plan, and you can have an impact with lots of other contingencies. And that's just, you know, an incredibly, to me, useful and animating and exciting way to be in relationship to history.
And Kate, I'm just kind of sort of ready now to roll up my sleeves and really delve into the chapters that each of you have written. And yours in particular immediately, you know, brought me back to these conversations, the Wisconsin School and the importance of economic variables. I started off saying that a lot of people believe American foreign policy is more partisan than it is, but there's some consistencies. I think one of those consistencies are the economic interests that the U.S. faces. So how much of grand strategy is really a response to the economic interests, economic coalitions within the United States? Because I think of, say, William Ackerman Williams and the importance of the agricultural sector needing to sell goods, you know, to China, and that motivating the open door. Is that fairly consistent part of grand strategy in the U.S., that it really is about jobs, jobs, jobs?
For me, I think it is. I think the exact expression of economic interest changes a great deal over time. I also don't think it's a sort of crude economic materialism or economic determinism. I think ideas, perceptions of reality matter a great deal here. I think that the Wisconsin School, which is sometimes caricatured as kind of economically deterministic, they were actually very good cultural historians as well, and very interested in ideas and meanings and perceptions. But I do see as a sort of long thread in American history, the importance of the quest for external markets as a really important core theme. I think it's not so much about jobs per se, and this is where there really is historical change over time and how exactly that interest in overseas markets gets expressed. But if you think of like Drew McCoy's classic book, The Elusive Republic, a lot of other work on kind of early American political economy. I mean, the access to markets played an absolutely crucial role in the kind of in Jeffersonian domestic political economy, as did access to more and more land on the American continent. But to me, this is kind of an idea I've been playing around with, but haven't really kind of ever fully worked out. But, you know, to me, kind of the two world wars in the 20th century and then the Napoleonic Wars a century before them, you know, are very much about the United States basically trying to exploit and profit from a conflagration in Europe on behalf of American export interests. And so freedom of the seas, I've argued, is, you know, when you kind of strip it of the sort of the moral aspect of it, it's also a very convenient way to argue that American business interests should have access to overseas markets and be able to sell to both sides in a major European war. I do see that as a kind of through thread in U.S. history. I think William M. Appleman Williams, who's a historian I admire very much, has probably, you know, made that argument more powerfully than anyone. Not just, you alluded to his kind of work on the agricultural interests, which really comes through in kind of one of his less famous book, The Roots of American Empire, the really well-known as Tragedy of American Diplomacy. But I do think that the exact way in which that interest in export markets kind of functioned within the American political economy has changed over time. So I think, you know, after the Civil War, when you get the kind of full onrush of industrial capitalism on steroids, you have it before the Civil War, certainly, especially after 1820, but then in a really serious way after the Civil War. You know, I think access to markets become less about enabling white men to improve their socioeconomic lot in the United States. It's a kind of small D democracy for white men, of course, dependent on preventing access to the same rights for others, that it becomes something more about kind of stabilizing the existing distribution of wealth and power within the United States rather than subverting it. So I think that that interest in overseas markets has been stable or has been consistent, is maybe a better word, throughout US history, but the exact implications of it, the exact expressions of it have been unstable and have changed over time.
I think a follow-up too, because you do delve into it. Again, we think of grand strategy and strategy. We think of, you know, military strategy certainly as a part of that as well. And your chapter definitely wrestles with that question about the importance of the Navy in American and military thinking. How much of that, the interest in the Navy, is really about the projection of power and these economic interests versus, you know, the work that I cited that you had written on the military-industrial complex? I guess part of it's how much of it is strategy, grand strategy, and how much of it is just appealing to the economic interests within the society?
I think a lot of it is about kind of, I think more of it, frankly, is about kind of satisfying domestic political economic imperatives than about projecting power outwards. It's not to say that the power projection argument isn't important. I think it's actually very important to Americans at the time. But it's really, it's almost like a Janus face where there's a foreign policy element to all the arguments about the Navy, and then there's a domestic side to all of the arguments. You can make the same thing's true of the Federal Reserve. I mean, so many of the arguments over kind of building the capacity that are necessary to be a more powerful player on the global stage have very different impacts within the United States on different parts of the country and different groups. And so in the case of the Navy specifically, that's very much a Republican priority, not a Democratic. The Democratic Party politics are kind of complicated. There is a segment within the Democratic Party that is interested, the kind of John Morgan wing of the party, in overseas access, and sees the Navy as important to get that market access. But, you know, the ships are going to be built in shipyards in the kind of North and the Midwest. Those are Republican strongholds who benefit from Republican protectionism. The Republicans are the party of tariffs at this time. The Democrats are the party of free trade. So I see it as very much a sort of it's not military Keynesianism in the sense that that term has been used to describe Roosevelt's policies in the 1930s, in part because Keynesianism hadn't really been invented yet. But the way in which scholars have really seen domestic political economic motives at work in Roosevelt's, the kind of early rearmament of the United States in the latter half of the 1930s, I think there's something similar here in the late 19th and early 20th century, that those domestic factors are really critical. And to divorce the foreign from the domestic, I think you end up with a very flawed understanding of what was really driving these people. That's essentially, I think, the argument of actually Fred Loegewald's chapter in the book too, that, you know, we really have to take very seriously the kind of the importance of domestic factors in U.S. foreign policy making.
Well, welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the book Rethinking American Grand Strategy with Chris Nichols of Oregon State University, Beverly Gage of Yale University, and Kate Epstein of the University of Rutgers-Camden. Christopher Nichols, your chapter wrestles with one of the most fascinating and increasingly controversial figures in American history, of Woodrow Wilson and the grand strategy coming out of the First World War. I don't know if it was an intention with your citing of Wilson and then citing of W.E.B. Du Bois, because that's, of course, what's become one of the more problematic aspects of Wilson is this question of race. So I do want to talk about that, but let's start with Wilson himself. Wilson's always described as an idealist. How idealistic is American grand strategy, and how consistent was Wilsonian idealism with the general, you know, historical grand strategy of the United States?
Those are enormous questions. And if we had another hour, I don't know if we could cover them, but I'll do the best I can. So one thing that's interesting in the scholarship on American grand strategy is that Wilson is often referenced and then disappears. But if you're a scholar of U.S. foreign relations, or really if you're just an idle, interested reader of U.S. foreign policy in some form or care about it, you definitely have a view on Wilson. One of the things that's perplexed me from the beginning of my graduate studies was just how many people care a lot about Wilson. They hate Wilson. They love Wilson. I've never been that invested, though I've spent a lot of time studying Wilson. I don't have really strong, deeply held views, which is probably useful to have at least a slightly clear-eyed perspective on his thought and policies. So the argument of my chapter is that we need to take Wilson seriously as a grand strategist, and that the policies that develop in the period from his presidency, when he comes into office in 1913, thinking he can focus on domestic politics, up through the sort of halting series of decisions and debates about U.S. entry into the war, which is really fascinating and important, at first coming out as a neutral, declaring in the along the lines that Kate said, that the U.S. should be allowed to trade with all belligerent parties without any interdiction of commerce. I mean, that's as grand a declaration as you could imagine in world historical terms, right? Belligerents have to let another power aid their enemies. Then that is kind of anathema in military strategy, right? Going back as far as you can find in the written human record. So that seems pretty important. And in fact, William Jennings Bryan resigns as Secretary of State, largely based on this kind of new neutral rights bubble logic of legal internationalism that comes out of this moment. And there are particular domestic sources here as well that I think are important to talk about in trying to generate a kind of compromise foreign policy that kept the U.S. out of the war for a period of time, but then also could help dictate the peace in some form. But the other thing when scholars have thought about and practitioners have thought about Wilson, they've often seen Wilson's grand strategy as flawed and a failure. Because, you know, in 1919, as everybody knows, the U.S. Senate rejected entry into the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles. And so the argument follows from some of the best thinkers on this subject that therefore this doesn't count as a grand strategy. Now, that's a slight caricature and people do take it slightly more seriously. But the point of my claim here is that there may be no more far-reaching set of policies and grand strategic diplomatic thinking than what Wilson was trying to put together at the risk of all other war aims, all 14 points. He was willing to sit them aside eventually at Paris for the 14th, for the League of Nations, thinking that that would be the thing that the U.S. could play a formative role in that would stop future bellicosity amongst large nations. And then, you know, in the sorts of ways that we've already been talking about, probably lead to much greater U.S. Economic prosperity, among other things, right? And a larger role in the world. And that's a real break, a real rupture from previous logics of U.S. foreign relations, which had largely dictated coming out of the Washingtonian, Jeffersonian kind of ideas about limiting entanglements and alliance structures. You could talk about it in terms of unilateralism, that the U.S. was acting on its own, or bilateral trade treaties. But this is something fundamentally different, that the U.S. would enter into this sort of organization. And I think you also broached the subject, well, where does that go? And there's been some really innovative work going back now quite a while, thinking about how Wilsonian ideas get taken up by other peoples and groups around the world and adopted and adapted for their own purposes. So here you get to, you know, we can talk about Wilson being uncaring or racist in some of the arguments and policy practices that come out of this, but self-determination as a concept for peoples and groups coming out of the war, coming out of colonialism, was something that was very much operationalized by other peoples and groups around the world. even such that we have amazing images and texts of, you know, the May 4th movement in China. You can see photos of people holding up banners of Wilson on all kinds of languages. You can see the 14 points and key phrases from Wilson being used to help throw off the shackles of empire, or to make arguments for racial justice or for self-determination in some other form. So, you know, one of the then secondary arguments that I make is that some of the internationalisms that come out of Wilsonianism also should count as grand strategy, or that are maybe that's unfair to them. And it might be better off to say that internationalisms were kind of aborning in the period of World War I, and they all bear loose resemblances, or many of them bear resemblances to each other. And so for me, a really important strand here isn't just Du Boisian sort of Black internationalism, which is crucial to think about in this moment, but also some of the others that are brewing in that time. And if you're coming out of an American lens, another one that's worth just pausing to think about is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and the first two American women to win the Nobel Peace Prize, Jane Addams and Emily Balch, who wind up setting up chapters all around the world and push for the outlawry of war movement. And this very much fits with many of Wilson's ideas, but it's taking and adapting them and actually kind of weaponizing them against the US state, saying the US should play much less of a role in this. The US should have joined the league, they would argue. And then we can see that, you know, having chapters and self-determination in other countries to push this forward through international non-governmental organizations, not through nation state structures. And so that's another key piece of this puzzle.
Seems like an ideal moment then to turn to Beverly Gage and the chapter on social movements. And I know part of the purpose of the chapter was to demonstrate that these social movements, these non-state actors, can have grand strategy. First question I want to ask is the role that they play in the construction of grand strategy, because we have this notion of grand strategy, kind of a Kissingerian realist notion of some master strategist, the Machiavelli, the Count Metternich sort of individual devising the strategy and then implementing that. But your chapter certainly suggests, and Chris's chapter does as well, that that's not necessarily done in a vacuum, that the role that these social movements can play at influencing the nature of grand strategy is really quite significant. How significant is it?
I think there are kind of two pieces at play. So one is, as you suggested, as Chris and Kate have already suggested, simply thinking about a grand strategist sitting alone in the room with a map of the world or a chessboard, right? All of these kind of great, you know, genius man metaphors is not ever, even when you have a genius man trying to do grand strategy, is not really the way that the process works. So that even when you're talking about the most traditional forms of grand strategy, there are all sorts of moving parts that are having an influence on this person. So to just take the Wilson example, right? It's not only that Wilson said self-determination and then movements around the world picked that up and said, we rally to this. You know, Wilson didn't actually think of self-determination, right? They thought of self-determination. Woodrow Wilson picked it up and they were like, hey, this is pretty useful to have a powerful figure endorsing this idea. And so we're gonna take on Wilson too. And so that symbiosis, right, that dynamic, the ways in which even the making of the most formal aspects of grand strategy or most traditional forms of grand strategy actually have all of these moving parts, domestic political concerns, pressures from below, et cetera. So that's one piece of it. And then I think the other, and this is in many ways, I think more what my essay is about, is that we also want to think of movements themselves as having strategies and having strategists and having grand strategists who have made change happen. So, you know, often when we talk about social movements, there's this idea of spontaneity, right? Someone says, hey, we're going to march on Washington and people of goodwill get together and they march on Washington and then stuff happens, right? Well, it's a much more complicated and much more intentional process in almost every major change that has occurred, certainly in US history and in many other areas of the world as well. And so part of what I wanted to argue in that essay is that we want to think of movements as having strategists and grand strategists. And in fact, a lot of the ideas that movement strategists have deployed, have talked about, have thought through, look a whole lot like what grand strategists have tried to do. So the figure that comes up most prominently in that essay is Saul Alinsky, sort of the granddaddy of community organizing. And so this is partly about, you know, can we think about Saul Alinsky as a grand strategist? Can we think about his tradition of community organizing as, in fact, a grand strategy of social change? And I think that we can. You know, certainly Alinsky himself thought that. He draws upon quite a lot of military strategy in his writings. He had a training school for young activists in which they sat down and read Thucydides and the Melian Dialogue, where all of these kind of classics of realist international relations. So Alinsky is nice because he was very self-conscious about this project. I think one of the challenges, and this might be one of the places that my attempt to put these pieces together breaks down, is that, you know, unlike Woodrow Wilson or Henry Kissinger or George Kennan, social activists sometimes aren't sitting around thinking, you know, let me write this out in a long memo or a long telegram, and let me put this all down and, you know, make my mark on history in that way. Of course, movements have lots of different moving pieces, and there's often no one leader, no one figure who's in fact making these decisions. So the challenges of strategy and grand strategy in that context are really very different. The means are very different. But I think there's enough in it to put those pieces together. And I think it's important for foreign policy folks to think about movements. And I think it's important for movement folks to think about policy and what they can learn even from military strategy and grand strategy.
And Kate Epstein, you had a response to that as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of just second everything that Bev just said. So I am not an expert on the modern civil rights movement. Both Chris and Bev would know much more about it than I do, but I've been reading kind of David Garrow's history of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And I just keep thinking to myself, like, King was such a gifted tactician and strategist. I mean, he really, you know, putting aside, you know, kind of the his concern with ethics, which ran very deep. I mean, this is a guy who had a really, really good sense of kind of how to balance short-term versus long-term, what he wanted his end state to look like. And I also just wanted to add, I don't know how aware people are of it, but Michel Foucault, who is not often thought of as in the context of grand strategy, he engaged very closely with the work of Karl von Clausewitz. He wrote about it. And it's really, if you've read Clausewitz, I mean, Foucault's take on Clausewitz, the way he uses him, is absolutely fascinating. The notion that kind of grand strategy tactics are kind of concepts that can, you know, pop up, you know, in lots of different contexts and be very productive analytical tools, I totally agree with.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the book Rethinking American Grand Strategy with Chris Nichols of Oregon State University, Beverly Gage of Yale University, and Kate Epstein of the University of Rutgers Camden. Now, sort of in this last section, what I'd like to sort of wrestle with is then, what does this mean for contemporary American grand strategy? And so President Biden has declared that the greatest international political challenge is a struggle between democratization and authoritarianism. There's clearly a grand strategy component about the advancement of democratization and what that necessarily would mean. I guess kind of a two-part question that is admittedly too large for the last 10 minutes of our conversation, but some initial thoughts about this, about how this fits with the history of American grand strategy, and, you know, perhaps some insights into where placing American foreign policy in that context, how sort of consistent is that, you know, with American foreign policy and the thinking broadly about grand strategy. Chris Nichols, I'll start with you.
So I think one of the things that comes out of our volume and came out of our many conversations about the subject is something that's this conversation is coalescing around, which is that there's a necessary interchange between domestic and foreign in American democratic politics and an understanding in particular grant strategies. And the most effective grant strategies, or you could just generalize it even more and say U.S. diplomatic kind of systematic thought has taken into account domestic political factors. So that some of the best examples of this are in the early Cold War. They're well known to scholars, but they're less well known to the wider public, which is, you know, famously the State Department was issuing amicus briefs related to, say, the Brown ruling in 1954, right? And so U.S. race relations, the absolute injustices going on the domestic home front had corollary effects abroad. They were helping the Soviet Union win the propaganda war. This is a great example that proves the rule of, in lots of other areas, from questions of religion or immigration and free speech, to racial justice, women's rights, sexual orientation, reproductive politics. You could go down a very long list of these, right, that they need to be taken account of by high-level policymakers, and they have been in the historical record and in the current moment. If you're thinking about what is Biden doing, what is this cabinet doing, you know, one of the things that stands out to me as a historian is you're looking at the most diverse cabinet in U.S. political history. And so what that suggests is that there are more types of people in the room, arguably more types of people with more kinds of views than doing the policymaking, representing a diverse population at home. And that would therefore then potentially lead to having more buy-in. And if you look at approval ratings for Biden's policies at home, virtually all of them are quite popular. There's another question embedded in what you said, which I think will be useful to listeners. And I'll be curious to know what my colleagues have to say here, which is that there's a longstanding question in thinking about grand strategy as to whether or not democracies are better or worse at it. And that, you know, there's no doubt in American political history that America's democratic political system has given, you know, our foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, a distinctive cast, right? There's no doubt about that. And that the debates, particularly the intransigence in Congress today, maybe suggest an incoherence or a possible incoherence in policy moving forward from that. So, you know, in the late Cold War, in the early moments after the Cold War, lots of Sovietologists were writing about this, trying to make sense of whether or not autarkic or totalitarian governments were better at grand strategy because they could have a unitary focus that could last, say, 100 years, right? And that's, if you're thinking about what are the grandest aspirations, as Bev Gage was saying, right, that long-term ends is, you know, across many administrations, is across generations would be your ends of a really big grand strategy. So what does that look like? You know, is Biden attempting that kind of project? Is that even possible in current American democratic politics? I'll leave all those questions there.
So Beverly Gage, you kind of raised some of the questions for you. Is it possible to have a grand strategy, both with respect to democratic politics and, of course, the partisan nature? There seems to be an aspect of American foreign policy that shifts, it seemingly pretty directly, depending on who wins the election.
The world of foreign policy and its relationship to electoral politics, I think, is pretty complicated, which is to say there is an idea that was valorized for a very long time that electoral politics, partisan politics, was supposed to end at the shore. And in fact, certainly since the Second World War, arguably even before that, there's been a kind of self-conscious production of a foreign policy elite. And it's a much more elite enterprise than democratic policy, right? A lot of foreign policy is done out of the White House, out of folks like that. And kind of increasingly, Congress doesn't play such a big role. And so I think for a long time, there was an idea that one way you dealt with the problem of elections was to have a kind of foreign policy elite that would be in place, that would share a set of ideas that in fact wouldn't change very much from administration to administration. That has certain good parts. It's also got some pretty serious downsides to it. And I think, you know, at this moment in particular, that sort of relatively sealed elite world is coming under real challenge, real pressure. The idea of experts who are not so responsive to electoral politics, in fact, carrying out decisions, I think that we're at a moment where it's in pretty bad flavor There aren't many people who are arguing for that. And so there are a couple of really interesting things going on right now as a result. So you raised the question of the Biden administration and democratization. Is this a useful framework? Well, democratization is one of those words and concepts that all sorts of things have been dumped into over the course of American history, you know, going back to a figure like Wilson, who was going to save the world for democracy through the Second World War, you know, even the Iraq War, right? Many, many things have been done in the name of democratization. So it really, I think, will depend on what exactly the Biden administration means by that. I think Chris is certainly right that this is a moment where the United States' legitimacy on this question around the world is being called into question. And so a lot of what's being done there will have to do with domestic politics, but I also think we could be at a much more interesting moment for grand strategy, which is to say that a lot of the language of the 1990s has all of the kind of optimism end of history moment. We've come to the end of history, I think, pretty definitively, so no one's holding on to that concept too firmly. And I think we're also at a moment of reaction against the kind of widespread aggressive use of American military power that we saw in the aftermath of 9/11. So we really might be at a moment where there's going to have to be a bigger rethinking of grand strategy. You know, Obama himself was sort of allergic to grand strategy. He didn't like it. He thought it was actually dangerous and just led to, you know, overconfidence and kind of stupid ideas, and that you made better decisions if you were just dealing with facts on the ground. Trump, of course, you know, people argued whether Trump had any strategy at all. I would say probably not. There were a bunch of ideas, and there might have been people in the Trump administration who thought of themselves that way, but it didn't have a lot of coherence in the end. So it's a really, I think, important and fluid and interesting moment that we're in, and possibly even one of those moments of real historical change that that don't come along all that often.
Kind of like the difference. Again, thinking about the grand strategy of democratization, the strategy of which countries you choose to target, because certainly there's an inconsistency, and the tactics of do you invade a country and compel democratization or support local groups, et cetera, you know, as a nice way to sort of think broadly about this. Chris Nichols, I do want to ask you, because it would be remiss to speak of grand strategy in the 21st century, and in particular in early 2021, or I guess now the middle of 2021, without referencing the pandemic. So sort of the last sort of question, you know, that I have about, has American grand strategy shifted because of the public health crisis, and how much is public health and the response to the pandemic a part of American grand strategy?
Yeah, so one of my favorite chapters in the volume that got all of us thinking was by Betsy Bradley and Lauren Taylor. And when we first started talking about this, this was 2015, 2016, so well before this pandemic. And the argument that they put forward was to look at George Bush's PEPFAR program, AIDS Relief for Africa, and what it was able to achieve, and to posit that the U.S. needed to think more capaciously about a public health grand strategy. And now all of us living through, you know, a global pandemic, I think it seems pretty clear that if the U.S. had had a more capacious public health grand strategy in January, say, 2020, and had been working more hand in glove with allies and international organizations like the WHO, you could envision a very different response, right? I think that's simple as a counterfactual to put out there and to agree with. So, you know, I recently wrote an op-ed with Betsy Bradley about this, where we argued that the U.S. needed to have a new global public health grand strategy to fit into the kind of thing that Beverly Gage was just describing, a kind of a thorough rethink of the U.S.'s role in the world in light of what's going on today in terms of inequality and all kinds of things that have been exposed by the pandemic, but not least that the U.S. has long traditions that have undermined its ability to be a serious player in global public health. And this goes back to World War I in particular. The U.S. didn't join the league, and it didn't participate in the League of Nations Public Health Organization. And then after World War II, in fact, though the U.S. was a major player in all the things we know coming out of reshaping the world in that era, when the WHO was being formed, the U.S. didn't literally have a seat at the table with the World Health Organization. It took a Soviet diplomat saying, no, the U.S. has to be a player in this, to literally be seated at the table of that decision making. And this runs into these longstanding patterns that we've been talking about for this whole conversation of the U.S., you know, wanting a kind of unilateral ability to get it, to achieve its own ends in foreign policy. And I don't mean to add this intentional sort of sensibility about U.S. foreign policy, but that these currents run deep in the ideology that structures foreign relations. And so if we're thinking about a global public health grand strategy, the U.S. giving away vaccines, as we've heard recently, the U.S. leading in changing intellectual property laws so that patents for vaccines and other things can be more easily distributed to other nations and groups and to multinationals. These are good initial steps if you're thinking about the stages of a kind of comprehensive public health grand strategy that would then fit into something that might qualify as a kind of containment-like vision that the Biden administration could be putting forward. Say also on questions that you were discussing about democratization, if the U.S. is defending democracy at home and pushing back against the forces that took the Capitol on January 6th, what does that look like abroad? Right? Does that look a little bit more like the early Cold War? Or does it look more like the more recent past with these interventions that were supposedly for democracy promotion, but have gotten the U.S. embroiled in wars that are now derided as forever wars, right? And so it seems like actually global public health is a great first step because it's something the U.S. could do collaboratively that would come at relatively little cost and could have tremendous kind of social gains, political capital gains around the world, but also at home.
So the name of the book is Rethinking American Grand Strategy, published by Oxford University Press. Our panel today have been three of the contributors to the book. Christopher Nichols is Associate Professor of History and Director of the Center for the Humanities at Oregon State University. He's one of the editors of the book and is also the author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of the Global Age. Beverly Gage is Brady Johnson Professor of Grand Strategy and Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. She is the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror, and a forthcoming biography on J. Edgar Hoover. And Kate Epstein is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University Camden. She is the author of Torpedo, Inventing the Military-Industrial Complex in the United States and Great Britain. Thank you all very much for an incredibly insightful conversation about grand strategy. And I certainly will carry forward a better understanding of what we mean by grand strategy and a renewed appreciation for the importance of history in the study of international relations. Thank you all very much.